This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, after what seemed like interminable length of time, the Mueller report is out, or at least a summary of it, a four-page summary of a 22-month investigation. I'm in a room here with more attorneys than you'd ever want to see at one time. And one more on the phone, that being Paul Charton, former U.S. attorney for Arizona. For the record, a George W. Bush appointee. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me, Mike.
Well, I have a question about the – well, we keep on saying Mueller report, but we really haven't seen that. We've seen a four-page summary written by the attorney general of the Mueller report, which is, by varying reports, 300 or 700 pages long. How much faith do you put in a high-level summary like that?
Well, therein lies the rub, exactly, Mike. So let me begin by saying first, I have a great deal of faith in Bob Mueller. He's somebody I know. I sat opposite the table from him when he did my personal vetting to become the U.S. attorney. So I think the public can have faith in the fact that this former Marine, this former career prosecutor, Bob Mueller, has cut square corners. The difficulty becomes, how do you take a 22-month investigation, 500 interviews, 500 search warrants, 2,700 subpoenas, and put it into a four-page summary and do so accurately? We have yet to see the underlying material. And in order to match that material with the summary, I think that's something the public's going to want to see very much. And I think, Mike, as you know, so far the call has been a bipartisan one to release the Mueller report in its entirety.
At least there was a unanimous vote in the House. The majority leader of the Senate kept it from coming up for a vote. That was, I think, that came out before the report itself, or before the Barr summary came out. They passed that resolution. I think there's a couple of other things that were questions that were raised about it. At the very end, there were two points I want to ask you about. This is a Barr's four-page summary. He says, well, we'll have to hold some stuff because it, quote, relates to matter occurring before a grand jury. And secondly, point a paragraph later, it says, well, there's issues that, quote, including those that the special counsel has referred to other offices. Those two phrases suggest to me that while Mr. Mueller may be done, this matter is not.
I think your instincts are good on that as well, Mike. So we know from reporting as recently as this week that the successor prosecutors, if you will, those prosecutors that Bob Mueller handed some of these matters off to, have indicated that there is a quote-unquote robust grand jury investigation that is still moving forward. They're still, for example, trying to get information from a foreign corporation, the name of which we do not yet know. We know that there's still the Roger Stone prosecution. We know that there are other cooperating witnesses, including Mr. Gates, for example. We know that the Southern District of New York, which has a well-earned moniker as the Sovereign District of New York because of its independence, is still conducting an investigation. So there are many other legal fights ahead of this president.
What would you the other oddity, I guess, about this that seemed to me, and I'm a layman, but watched this somewhat carefully, the decision not to push a formal face-to-face interview with President Trump, that struck me as odd.
I agree. It is odd. And it's so far, in my mind, unexplained. Again, Bob Mueller is a seasoned prosecutor, so I'm going to assume he has a good reason for not insisting on or pushing an interview. Step back, too, and point out, Mike, that here's the one thing that I think we can all agree on as Americans. Although, as you say, there is an odd tone to what I'm about to say, because we can know now with certainty that Bob Mueller did not recommend that the president be charged with the crime of conspiring with the Russians to interfere with the 2016 election. That's good news for us. It's good news for all Americans, because had that decision been otherwise, it might have been one of the darkest days in our nation's history. But apart from that succinct conclusion, there are many other questions, as you point out. What was, for example, the weight of the evidence that Bob Mueller had before he came to the conclusion that he didn't want to charge the president with conspiracy? Was it, as the president and his supporters say, complete exoneration? Or was it something that I've seen more often in my experience, having reviewed hundreds of FBI reports, that there was some level indicating that there was a wrong that took place here, but perhaps just not enough evidence to prove that wrong beyond a reasonable doubt?
The Barr memo seemed to draw a distinction. There were two essential issues. One was collusion or conspiracy. The other was obstruction of justice. And the Barr memo seems to draw a clear distinction between those two. My read of what, at least what Barr said, is I didn't find evidence of conspiracy, but with respect to obstruction of justice, he seemed to say, well, there was evidence for and there was evidence against, and it's in the realm of prosecutorial discretion. Is that a fair statement?
It is. Bob Mueller had, if you will, two buckets of findings. The first bucket, as you accurately point out, said we ought not to charge the president with the crime of conspiring with the Russians. And the second bucket said there are facts and law on both sides of whether or not the president should be charged with obstruction of justice. And again, another peculiar aspect of this, because this really was Bob Mueller's job to call a ball or a strike here, to make a decision, charge or don't charge. He said, according to the Attorney General's report, that he wasn't going to make that decision and therefore left the decision to the Attorney General to make. And as you know, the Attorney General decided that he would not go forward with an investigation or charge relating to obstruction of justice.
Well, I want to pick that up. We're going to break right now, but I want to pick that up because, and I want to ask you to elaborate on that a little bit. I thought that was the whole point of a special prosecutor, which was to remove the prosecutorial discretion from anybody connected with the political process and put it in the hands of an independent such as Mr. Mueller. And what he did, again, odd. It struck me as odd. He kicked it back to a politically appointed attorney general. I'll come back and give you a chance to elaborate on anything else you'd like to observe about this. But when we do come back, I want to start with that one and ask you to comment on that. We'll be back in just a moment in the think tank. We're talking to Paul Charlton, former U.S. attorney for the state of Arizona. We'll be back in just a moment.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're here in the Think Tank. We're discussing the Mueller report, which we have to keep reminding ourselves no one outside of a handful of people has yet seen. We have seen a four-page document by the Attorney General, Mr. Barr, which purports to summarize that report. And now when you go from either 300 to 700 pages to four, at a minimum, you're going to lose a lot of interesting detail and leave a lot of open questions. And by the way, also have with us, and we will be talking later in the show, we have three other attorneys, Tom Ryan, Lauren Molliver, and Bob Frank. I'm going to give them a moment for questions when I finish mine. And I left you before, Mr. Charlton, I left you with a kind of a question at the break, which was the issue of why does isn't the whole idea of a special prosecutor that they will make the call on whether or not you prosecute? The idea of kicking it to the attorney general struck me as, isn't that the whole idea of what a special prosecutor is there to preclude?
That is, Mike, as you say, the very nature of the job. You are the individual who is supposed to be conducting a fair and objective and apolitical investigation. You are the person who is not appointed by the president, not appointed by anybody with any political leanings, to do the investigation. So why it is And not just the investigation, but as you correctly point out, the conclusion. So why it is that Bob Mueller did not come to a conclusion here as it relates to obstruction when he felt willing to come to a conclusion as it related to conspiracy is yet another. And I think that word you use is a good one, oddity, and one that the American people deserve to have answered by looking at that report that Bob Mueller put together.
And in fairness to Mr. Mueller, who has been silent, I think, with a great deal of appropriate circumspection, we've yet to hear. These are good questions, and I assume at some point he's going to answer them either before Congress or in public, or in these questions may all indeed be even answered within his report.
That's right. And to be clear, Mike, these aren't just questions that someone in the public who's not trained in the law would ask. These are questions that career prosecutors would ask. Why wouldn't you interview the president? Why wouldn't you come to a conclusion as to whether or not someone should be charged or shouldn't be charged? Isn't that your task? How is it an investigation as thorough and as long and as detailed as this didn't give you enough information to say, under the standards of the Department of Justice, we can or we cannot charge?
Didn't Mr. Barr, I want to ask you about that 18-page memo that he wrote. This is before he's attorney general, might have had something to do with his getting the appointment in the first place. Tell us, if you would, what that said and how you feel about that.
So Mr. Barr, who has a very good reputation, before he received this appointment and was confirmed as attorney general of the United States, submitted a letter to the President of the United States and to the then Attorney General, indicating that he did not believe that under certain circumstances the President could be charged with obstruction of justice. During his confirmation hearings, he attempted to clarify when it is he thought the President ought not to be charged with obstruction and when it is the President could be charged with obstruction of justice. But to your more specific point, Mike, we don't know to what degree his prior thinking on that issue has influenced the outcome of his decision not to charge the president here on obstruction. And yet again, another reason for why it is we should see that report. Let me just add here, too, if I may, Mike, it isn't just Bob Mueller, who was an extraordinarily experienced and well-respected prosecutor. Mueller put together the varsity team, and even better than the varsity team. These are Olympic caliber prosecutors, if you will, individuals that he selected from around the country to gather together to handle this investigation. Now, I know there has been some criticism that individuals in that team had political bias, but my knowledge of Mr. Mueller and my understanding of who he is tells me that he would not have allowed any of those individuals to allow their political bendings or leanings to have influenced his report at all.
And for the record, Mueller is a Republican, though not noted for any particular partisanship.
Correct. No, he's a Republican, a longtime Republican.
Mm-hmm. Tom Ryan had a question for you.
Paul, just your take on this. How many, when you look at this report from Mueller, which nobody's had a chance outside a handful to look at, we now are getting reports that it's somewhere between 300 and 700 pages. How likely is it that Bill Barr actually did a thorough review of it before he prepared that four-page summary?
It's a great question, Tom. And what I'd add to that, just beyond, say, the volume of the pages, is that when you are on the investigation team, you're living with those facts every day. You're participating in the interviews of the witnesses. You're assisting in the drafting of the affidavits that support the search warrants. You're talking about the strategy as to which subpoenas should issue. So the profound level of knowledge that you have as it relates to your case has to be taken into account when you come to a conclusion about whether someone should be charged or not be charged. So your question is an outstanding one. How is it that on a Friday, when you receive this investigation, you feel confident enough that on a Sunday, you can tell the public that we ought not to charge someone with obstruction of justice? That's an extraordinary leap. It may be, again, once we see the investigation and its report in full, that there is good reason to come to that conclusion. But your instincts are right, and I think it's another reason we need to see what that underlying report was.
I have one more follow-up question to that. Mr. Barr was a prior attorney general under the George Herbert Walker Bush administration. And he was in charge of overseeing the Iran-Contra affair and doing prosecutions in that. And I recall from that time that Mr. Barr was widely criticized because he shut down the investigation before they could indict then-Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger and even Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush. I said under Bush, but it was under Ronald Reagan is when Iran-Contra occurred. Do you think that that past played any part in Trump's decision to appoint him while this investigation is pending?
That's a great question, and I don't have the answer to that, Tom. But what I can say is that I know a number of people, including Jim Comey, who I know, who respect Bill Barr. So whether or not at the end of the day this was the right decision is only going to be explained to us when and if we see the Mueller report.
Oh, indeed, indeed.
Thank you very much. Paul Charlton, former U.S. Attorney for Arizona. We'll be back with our panel in the think tank picking up on this discussion when we return in just a moment. Thank you.
I was a lonely soul. I had nobody till I met you. But you keeping me waiting all of the time. What can I do? It's your life, and you can do what you want. Do what you like, but please don't keep me waiting.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, I want to thank, first of all, Paul Charlton for joining us. He's moved on. Paul was the former U.S. attorney for the state of Arizona. And for those of you not in the legal world don't understand the significance of, that's basically the lawyer for the United States within the domain of the state of Arizona, reports directly to the attorney general. Tom Ryan, old friend, is back here. Now, Tom, we usually introduce him as our chief legal troublemaker. He's got competition, however.
Serious
competition here. Lauren Molliver and Bob Frank are noted contestants for that moniker. Troublemaker challenge. Okay, so we have here. You can decide yourself. It's either three wise men, three stooges, or take your pick.
We'd go with the three stooges.
You missed the hand motion there. Okay. Bob, when we were talking in the break, you made, a really good point, because if we're looking at even the Barr summary, that's Barr meaning the not the legal Barr, but the Attorney General Barr summary, did lead with a point that, as you pointed out, is
complete. It's monumental. So they're losing sight of the fact that it's been established that the Russians interfered with our election, and it's very likely to have affected the result, which to me impugns the integrity of the electoral system and the results.
One of the issues that I've been thinking of along with that point, Bob, is that from the outset, if I'm Donald Trump and I am elected president of the United States and learn that the Russians interfered with the election, hopefully I would be man enough, president enough, to acknowledge it and to want to have the country do something about it. And yet since the election, to my knowledge, there's been very little activity, if any, of significance with respect to what are we going to do about that. Our election coming up in 2020 is as vulnerable, I think, as we were in 2016.
Well, we have a problem with the Department of Homeland Security saying that they're not going to take any additional steps to increase cybersecurity. And
that would be the group you think would deal with it. Our elections are, I think it turns out to be, fortunately, are run separately by 50 states and even actually at a more micro level than that. In Arizona, the elections are really run at the county level. I take some comfort in that it's probably a whole lot harder to mess with the systems in 3,000 independent county-level systems in this country than it is one national system.
True, but it's...
But for cybersecurity and messing with social media and things like that, if anybody you think should deal with it, I can't think of anybody at the level of the Homeland Security other than...
DOJ for housing discrimination by... under the Housing and Urban Development group. Yeah, they've been placing discriminatory ads about housing to discourage African Americans from loaning. But I want to get back to this. Let's stick to the – yeah.
That's a little off topic.
Yeah, I apologize. It is. But what's happened here is, yeah, they really messed with social media. And we had a discussion before we started about tribalism in America and how it's – we're less united and more divided, and whether it's the issue of gun control or gun rights or the issue of immigration, we're having this problem.
By the way, I want to just jump in so people understand when we talk about messing with social media, how that's done. There were documented thousands of Russian trolls who got good enough at English that they basically seeded the Facebook in particular, with all sorts of things to promote dissensus within the country. And they're still there.
Yes.
And you don't know who's an American and who's a Russian. And a lot of the stuff that basically got people, I don't think they set out, by the way, to elect Donald Trump. I think they set out to create dissensus in this country. And frankly, you have to admit they succeeded.
And I disagree with that. I think that they did intend to elect Donald Trump. And the Trump campaign were willing participants. They encouraged it. You know, when they went to meet with the Russian operatives, Donald Trump Jr., he was told that they had dirt on Clinton. He said, I love it.
Yeah. But by the way, I think I had the word, or I intended to have the word initially. I think initially Putin was out to stick it to Hillary Clinton, who he loathes on a personal level. I think that at that moment, early on, electing Donald Trump was wildly beyond their wildest expectations. That may have evolved over time. But in the beginning, Hillary was out there and Putin hates her.
And that could be. But we know since 2004 and earlier that Trump has been inextricably interwoven from a financial standpoint with Russian interests and even people close to Putin. So there might have been a real motivation.
And some of that may be the subject of investigation in the Southern District of New York, which is part of the Mueller thing's over, which was charged really with only – they were exclusively charged with dealing with the Russian involvement in the election and anything that flows from that.
You know, with respect to the report – the Mueller report and the Barr memo, which really isn't even four pages. It's really two relatively short paragraphs following introductory fluff. But we are a nation in many respects of precedence. And when we look back to the Watergate issues, if we recognize that Leon Jaworski put
he
together,
was the Watergate special prosecutor.
Thank you. And he put together the famous roadmap, which was nobody has yet seen, but was a document that went through the report and pointed out the facts and was the roadmap to Congress.
By the way, and there was one important difference between that. Jaworski's report was to the Congress of the United States. It went to the Congress in its entirety. It did not go to the Attorney General.
And that was part of the point I was going to make, because the law has changed. And the report that Mueller did by law had to go to the Department of Justice, where I think it should have gone straight to Congress like they did in the days of Watergate.
Well, we have the absurdity of this supposed independent entity is reporting to a hand-picked Attorney General of the when the subject of the investigation is the president, goes to a hand-picked attorney general. That to me defies the logic of independence.
As lawyers, we know that if a judge in one of our cases made a pronouncement before the case of a predisposition toward the result, the judge should recuse him or herself.
And almost always would.
Or would be subject to being removed. And none of us would ever try a case in front of that judge with that knowledge. And that's exactly what happened here. We have such a conflict of interest with respect to Attorney General Barr that it sounds like sour grapes because his memo does to a degree give Trump the ability, even though it's a lie, to claim he was fully exonerated.
He has said that, quote unquote, full exoneration, which doesn't seem to me is even consistent with the Barr memo.
Correct.
The Barr memo, if you stretch it on the first point of collusion, you could claim full exoneration. On the second point, which is, help me here, the second point is obstruction of justice.
Right.
It absolutely is not. In fact, it explicitly, the Barr memo says that it explicitly is not exoneration.
Right. And with the first issue, it really is talking about, as I think Paul pointed out, it's the crime of conspiracy, not collusion. Collusion is an activity that would lead one to think there might be a conspiracy.
But we're stuck with that because they've been using that word for months now. Yeah.
Well, that's part of the problem, though. Yeah. We're stuck with it because Trump has said it umpteen times.
Collusion is not a crime. Conspiracy is the crime.
Right. Correct. And the report said there wasn't enough evidence to support a charge for conspiracy. And that may or may not be true. If we give Barr's memo the benefit of the doubt for now, that doesn't mean there wasn't activity following up on Bob's comments by the campaign, Don Trump Jr. in particular, that we know of, that is uncontrovertible, that there isn't impeachable offense in that activity.
And there's a lot of political spin going on here and propaganda, but it's one thing to say that there's not adequate evidence beyond a reasonable doubt to recommend that there be an indictment with regard to conspiracy. It's another thing to say that there's no facts or evidence to support some type of conspiracy.
In fact, even the Barr memo said there's a lot on both sides.
Exactly.
So we will return for a final segment. We have with us Tom Ryan, Lauren Molliver, and Bob Frank, all local attorneys. The one he's, I think, is not practicing, but all
he got it right.
He got it right. Yeah. Classmates, too, I understand.
Exactly.
Okay. We'll be back in the think tank and wrap up our discussion of really, I say the Mueller report. This is really a discussion of the Barr memo because nobody outside of a small group of people has yet seen the Mueller report.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back with three more attorneys than you'd want to meet in a bar. Tom Ryan, Lauren Molliver, and Bob Frank. Okay, we've been talking about what we know, which is probably a lot less than we think we know. There is a whole lot of ongoing investigations. The Mueller report got all of the press, but there's a whole lot going on. Can you run us through that?
Sure. First off, the grand jury that was convened for the special counsel is still going on.
Referenced in the Barr memo.
Yes.
Saying that's one of the reasons why we can't show you, because there's still this. That was one of two things he referenced.
Correct. There's a foreign bank that we don't know the name of where that case had just gone up to the Supreme Court. They declined to set it aside. So it's now back down in front of the grand jury again. There are
a bank that funded Trump's businesses.
Yes, everybody's there.
Other than Deutsche Bank.
Other than Deutsche Bank. It's a big parlor game with all the legals. They believe it's a bank from one of the oil rich Mideast companies.
Mm-hmm. So my bet would be Saudi, given
who knows. It could be. Yeah, who knows? So it wouldn't be a bad guess. But you also have a lot of there have been a lot of investigations that the Mueller team has handed off to the U.S. District Court in District of Columbia, in Virginia, and in Southern District of New York, which are also spawning off other investigations. Currently, right now, there are 17 investigations into Trump and Trump Organization that we know of. And it's not just at the federal level. For example, the New York Attorney General is going after the Trump Organization. They've shut it down.
The charity.
The charity that wasn't so charitable, exactly. They never held meetings. They didn't have any financial accountability for any other things.
Main purchase was a portrait of Donald Trump.
Yeah, that's not even the worst of it. Yeah. It's just the most egregious. Yeah. It's the one that everybody can grab their brain.
He also paid for his flagpole fine.
He also paid for his son's Boy Scout dues out of the Trump organization.
All right, let me ask a question. This is a Trump supporter would say the following. See, you're just out to – you just don't like Donald Trump. You just won't let it go.
Oh, I don't like Donald Trump, but that's not the issue. It's also about the issue of we got to follow the rule of law. And there are Democrats also that have been caught up in this investigation. John Podesta's brother, there was somebody announced just this last week, Craig I'm trying to remember his last name. His last name is Craig, but he was a he was in the White House counsel's office for Obama. There are a lot of people that have been caught up, and it's not just Trump. But here's the deal: we are a nation of laws. We don't have a monarchy here, and so when these laws are violated, they need to be prosecuted, and they should be prosecuted even-handedly. Something that Paul Charlton brought up was. Mueller is the guy that's going to call the balls and strikes and all these things. And what we're seeing in the Southern District of New York, same thing. It's balls and strikes. And the same thing with the U.S. District Court of Columbia in Virginia.
I want to read that report. I want to find out why he didn't make the call on the issue of obstruction. I mean, it boggles my mind. The guy who spent 2 years of his life with a lot of resources and did all these hundreds of interviews and all that, isn't that the guy who has the most – ability to make the judgment about whether or not that's what prosecutors do all the time. They assimilate all the evidence and they make a call, as opposed to kicking to somebody who reads the 300 to 700 pages in an afternoon. And
without trying to be repetitious, or let Congress make the call. Mm-hmm. A lot of people lose sight of the fact that Congress is a co-equal branch of government, and they have a duty to be oversight of the executive branch.
I also wonder to what extent Mueller was affected by the fact that his boss and other people had determined that there can be no obstruction of justice regardless of what the facts were. And that could have possibly had an effect on his judgment.
The Barr memo says that had nothing. We didn't even get there.
Exactly.
I think the Barr memo should be best looked at as a narrative created by Barr. I'm deeply suspicious that he read however long this Mueller report is. I'm deeply suspicious that he was able to read it, synthesize it, understand it. I guarantee you there are footnotes. I guarantee you there are links to internet research that was done. There's no way that he could have done it in that short of a time frame and come up with this.
On the other hand, I would imagine he would be somehow constrained. You can't invent something. You do that. You can't invent it out of whole cloth or else because you're going to get caught.
Yeah. Well, if you look there, in the Barr memo, there are a lot of weasel phrases and weasel words that will allow him to say, well, that was your interpretation. That's not exactly what I said. I mean, he was very clever in the way that he wrote that memo.
And there was a report yesterday. I'm sorry, remember the source, but it was that Mueller's office reported to the attorney general approximately 3 weeks ago that there wasn't going to be a conclusion. So there was some advance notice to the attorney general's office of at least that fact. How much that allowed Barr to do any prep work before getting the report, or whether he did, I certainly don't know. One last comment, if I can. There's a lot of talk about the failure to interview the president, and that is from a legal perspective, that's very curious to me, certainly. But we also know there were written questions to him, and that the president answered them. So I'm dying to see, and I assume it's an exhibit to the report, what were the questions and what were the answers? Because as lawyers, when we do written discovery and we ask questions and we get answers, we usually like to follow that up with a deposition so that we can pursue.
Well, as a precursor, but you think he wrote those answers or did his attorneys?
I'm sure he didn't write the answers for two reasons. One, I don't know that he's capable of, and yes, I am showing my bias. Two, he said he did, so I assume he didn't.
And it doesn't even matter. The answers would have been the same. The interesting thing is that both of these charges are based in great measure on intent, mens rea. So how do you determine the intent of a particular person without even having them testify? That's a very difficult thing, and Trump was probably
smart. You ask them, why did you do this?
Exactly. But a lot of times what you see is that more people are convicted for covering up a potential crime than the crime itself. And everybody knew if Trump testified, there would be some prevarication involved.
Yeah,
in
the lawyer was willing to quit if he testified.
John Dowd.
John Dowd, who's a really good attorney, said, yeah, I can't let him testify. And
on the other hand, he did tell us all in the Lester Holt interview why he fired Comey. And that, to me, is evidence of intent. It's not sworn testimony, but it doesn't have to be.
Nope.
To show what evidence there was of his intent
on the obstruction.
Right. An admission by a party opponent is admissible at the time of trial, and that it's that Rusher thing,
right?
And he also said when he had the meeting early on in his presidency with the Russian delegation, and he made a comment again about firing Comey
the day afterward,
right? And they were laughing about it,
right?
And there was some ambivalence though in those. In those interviews as well, because he went on to talk about, and maybe he did this purposely, about how he doesn't think that Comey is capable of handling these matters.
Well, we're clearly not done yet. As the song says, we're still waiting. The Mueller report, I can't imagine that we don't get at least significant pieces of it at some point, because my biggest takeaway from this discussion is we don't know a whole lot more than we do know at this point. We know there's no prosecution on these two specific points, but there's others out there. And the consensus here seems to be that the reasoning behind these is at this point completely unclear. Hopefully the Mueller report itself would be more clear on that point, or Mr. Mueller himself in testimony.
We still don't have his tax returns, and we'll probably get this report after the 2020 election.
Okay. See you next week in the Think Tank.
Thank you.